kind of stuff. Good.
Okay, so let us begin then. Before we start today, I want to just make some comments about last time people communicated with me afterwards. First, I want to mention something to Dove Weinstock. I see he's on emailing me. I actually knew it, but I forgot it at the time. I had mentioned that there's the Orthodox synagogues with mixed choirs are no longer in existence. And since we have someone from Australia on, or usually on, I can mention that Raymond Apple, who's a rabbi in Australia, wrote a long article on this. But Dove reminded me that there is, to this day, in Liverpool, the only Orthodox, maybe this Chabad, but the main Orthodox synagogue in Liverpool. You can go to their website. I can send you the link if anyone's interested. And they proudly announced that they are the only Orthodox shul left in existence that has a mixed choir. However, what I meant last time was that the United Synagogue, that is the overarching under the chief rabbi in England, they had synagogues with mixed choirs. The synagogue in Liverpool is an independent Orthodox synagogue, because when Chief Rabbi Jacobowitz became chief rabbi, he made it a mission to get rid of all the last of the synagogues. I think it was called Hampton Gardens, to get rid of the last of the synagogues that had the mixed choir. But there still is one mixed choir, and truthfully, from a pure halachic standpoint, you don't even see the people for the choir up out of the, you don't see them. There's really no technical violation other than the fact that it's certainly not the the traditional Jewish way of doing things. But that was interesting. Oh, no, it's not Dove Weinstein, not Dove Weinstock. So we have a Dove Weinstein, maybe not on this week, but on certainly on last week. Maybe there'll be a renaissance. Well, I don't know. Maybe with Shira Hadasha. But no, the Kolisha wouldn't have been in business anyway. First of all, you don't see the woman. They're up high, up behind. If you ever go to these synagogues that have choirs, many of them you can't see the choir because they're behind the curtain or the... they're in a place you don't see them. You don't want to be distracted by seeing them sing. At least that's how it is in many places. And second of all, if you want to argue halachically, there's the famous Tshuva of the Sri Diyesh. We already spoke about it, that holy songs don't arouse people to lust. That's the whole basis for the singing of songs in NCSY, etc. But it, as I said, it's hard to imagine anything more untraditional than having women sing in a choir in a shul. One other point I want to clarify. We were talking a bit about Rav Moshe Feinstein and calling people up for aliyahs, and we'll get back to that as well today. I have to clarify what I said, because I looked in the tshuva of Rav Moshe. I am not sure that Rav Moshe has a problem with counting a reform rabbi to a minyan. In fact, the simple understanding of his tshuva is that you can certainly count a reform rabbi to a minyan, because he says you can count kofrim, heretics. What Rav Moshe Feinstein says is that you can't give them an aliyah, because he assumes that, as he says, many of them don't believe in God. I don't know if that's empirically true, but he says since they don't believe in God, you can assume many of them don't. Therefore, the brachas have no meaning. And it's this tshuva that I mentioned that Rav Yehuda Herzl Henkin takes issue with, because for some rishonim, it doesn't seem to matter what the individual believes. But Rav Moshe is clear, from at least from a pure halachic standpoint, that anyone can be counted in a minyan, although I imagine l'migdar milta, as they say, or to make an emergency measure or to for standards, or however you want to put it, he might say don't count them, but his tshuva does state that deniers can be counted in a minyan, because the meraglim, the spies, he says, were the greatest deniers. So I just want to clarify that. Inside, we are told in some conservative shows there's a mixed choirs, I have no doubt, although I wonder if this is a recent thing or was still going on years ago. Let us then pick up where we left off. Yes, comment.
I was just going to say, in the Sri Deyesh, if I'm not mistaken, in the tshuva, he writes that if somebody's intermarried, then it's a policy decision of the kahal whether they want to count them towards a minyan. That al-fi halakha, an intermarried person... This is, of course, you know, in a previous generation when intermarriage was a little bit different than it is now. You can count them towards minyan fi halacha, but you clearly have the right to rabbanim, as you say, l'migdar milta, to decide like not to count an intermarried person for a minyan also, just on the same topic.
We'll actually get it. We'll talk about this a little later today, but he doesn't actually say that. He says that the person who intermarries really has the status of being put in chayrim, and that therefore he shouldn't be counted to a minyan, if I'm remembering it okay. I don't believe he gives that, I don't, if I remember correctly, he doesn't, I didn't discuss this in the book, but he doesn't give that as a possibility that they should. He's very strong against it. If I recall correctly, I will certainly check on that, but we're going to see today that the Binyan Sion has a more liberal opinion. Let me make a note for that. I'll check on, though, for next class. And you'll see
I'll take a look, too, in the 3DA chapter class, but okay.
Yeah, I'll mention what Rav Yosef says today. The 3DH is actually pretty strong on it. But, okay, we'll get to that. We ended last class speaking about the issue of Mila, which the reformers wanted to abolish, at least some of them, and in particular, Mitzitza, the sucking out of the blood. And that's where. And I mentioned also that you know, this is one of the things that in most of the, at least our circles, you don't see it anymore, but it's certainly done among the Hasidim and many Haredim. Now, if you just look at the Talmud, without any preconceived notions, it appears obvious that mitzitza, that is, sucking out the blood from the wound of the mila, is simply a health measure. And you find any number of authorities who state explicitly that it's only a health measure. There's no religious component to it at all. What's the significance then? It was thought in ancient times to provide healing. You know, there's this notion of bloodletting. So if you let the blood out, it brings out the bad blood. Good blood can come in. I mean, that was a major way of healing in ancient times. The Mishnah speaks about letting blood. Can you let blood out of someone on Shabbos? They were thought to be bad humors and all sorts of things. And this went on, by the way, until a few hundred years ago. They still had bloodletting. The problem was, with the increase of knowledge in medical areas, people started questioning how hygienic it was to do it with the mouth. When people started getting understandings of how disease was spread, etc., early in the 19th century, people started wondering, first of all, does this have any medical value whatsoever? And even if you say it has medical value, which they doubted, isn't this... doesn't it destroy everything you're doing? Because if you put someone's mouth to it, this could spread all sorts of communicable diseases. In addition, there were a number of well-publicized cases in the early 19th century of disease being spread, and it did appear that it was spread from moel to baby or vice versa. You had babies who died. Now, if you want to see the medical details about this, including documentation of early medical writing, I recommend a very interesting journal called Hakira. In fact, it was in the journal Hakira that one of the speakers at your conference wrote this article, which I assume how he came to your attention. It's an interesting article because it's published, we don't have another journal like this, I mean, it's an interesting journal. It's published by Balabatim in Brooklyn, but very learned Balabatim, not professional scholars, and my sense is almost that they come from the Haredi world, but have found it too constricting and want to move out with recognition of modern scholarship. So some of the articles, you could say they're even reinventing the wheel, but many of them are interesting new material, and one of them was written by Dr. Shlomo Sprecher, who's a radiologist by profession, but certainly a big Talmud Chacham and a learned person, and he wrote an article, a very strong, I guess you would say anti-Mitzitza article, which is incredible coming out of Brooklyn, but it covers all the documentation. Now, as I said, the reformers wanted to abolish Mitzitza entirely, and they passed a resolution stating as much at one of the reform conferences. Later, tools were developed that allow you, at least they thought, that you could draw the blood out without using the mouth, and this became the preferred method for most of the Orthodox, and I'll get to Jacob Katz in a minute. Good point. Now, today, I believe that only the Hasidim still insist on it as a matter of principle. That is, they attach all sorts of mystical significance to it. Many Haredim also do it, that is, yeshiva people, but as far as I know, there's no mystical connotations. They do it because this was thought to be Minhag Yisrael, the custom for many generations. However, if it's pointed out that there's a danger, they will be quicker to stop doing it. And the fact is that in Lithuania, where these people are supposed to come from ideologically, many great Gedolim said, even in the 19th century, there's no need to do it. It's the same thing. After all, what's the difference? If you're using a gauze or if you're using some sort of mechanism and you draw out the blood, what does using your mouth have to do with anything? Why is that significant? Another article pointed out tradition. I think even if you told them there was a far-fetched danger, they wouldn't think of it, because it's not a real minhag. The fact that today you do have some yeshiva people who are acting like it's a real minhag, which you did not have in the early 20th century or late 19th century. I mean, if you look at the names of the gedolim who wrote about this, you could see that. I think perhaps this is influence of Hasidic world, or maybe general Frumkeit that's taken over. In fact, I even saw someone from that world who wrote an essay talking about, in his mind at least, how crazy it is that the Aguda, which is more of a Lithuanian type of crowd, is so strong in defending this Mitzitza B'peh when there appears to be a clear and present medical danger. All I would say in defense of the Aguda, however, is that there are important constitutional questions at stake here, dealing with religious freedom. And these can't be taken lightly. If the government is permitted to ban a religious ceremony, even if it's only practiced by some people, because of what they think is a medical necessity, even though we're only dealing with a couple cases, who knows where that could lead to? And it could lead to medical supervision of mo'alim, you know, all sorts of things. Now, it hasn't happened in the United States, but it always pays to be aware of these things. So that's the situation. However, before the new tools were developed, the next time you're at a bris milah, pay attention to how the mohel does it. Before these tools were developed, you either could do it with your mouth, or you could do it with a gauze, which didn't really wasn't that effective, at least it was thought. So the question was, reformers were saying we have to get rid of mitzitza. Should Jews, from Jews, Talmudically oriented Jews, get rid of a practice which the Talmud says is important, indeed vital, for health reasons, because of the new information, or the supposedly new information, that there's no health benefit? Again, the issue at first had nothing to do with the tuberculosis epidemic or anything like that, or cholera. And in such a case, you know, where there is an epidemic, everyone agrees, you don't do it. The issue was, as a general rule, are we going to abolish something permanently because of what might occur? And the issues 150 years ago were the same issues that happened in New York City 2 years ago. And Ettlinger, although I've tried to portray him so far as someone who is a precursor in some ways to so-called modern orthodoxy, it must be stated that in this area, he was a strong advocate of Mitzitza B'peh. Now, one of the questions scholars ask, and Yaakov Katz is at the forefront of this, is would he have had such strong feelings if the reformers were not trying to abolish it? In other words, if this was an internal orthodox issue, would it have led to such strong feelings on the other side? And we have many examples of where when things develop internally in the orthodox community, they don't seem to be that big a deal. But when it's the conservatives that suggest to the reformers take prenuptial agreements or any number of things, we see there's a lot of hesitation. Going back to the Chasam Sofer we spoke about in lecture number one of last year, that what is new is forbidden from the Torah. That only applies when the reformers are trying to make changes. So that's the question scholars wonder. For example, and you can often trace this by looking, when new issues arise, look in the Sephardic world. If the Sephardic rabbis don't seem to have any trouble with it, and the Ashkenazic rabbis are having all sorts of difficulties and pointing out all sorts of problems, you can be pretty well assured that they are concerned with where it's going to lead to, that this might be the first step down the reformist road. The Sephardic rabbis are able to look at matters much more of a vacuum, without being worried about whether it's going to encourage reform or whether it will give an imprimatur to the people who are trying to reform Jewish practices. So once the reformers came out publicly and demanded the abolition of Mitzitza B'peh, is it any wonder that the leading Orthodox spokesman adopted the other position and wouldn't even give an inch? It took a long while, to the end of the 19th century, before Orthodox authorities were able to start advocating doing Mitzitza in a different fashion. And we can understand the strong feelings, I think, about Mitzitza, when we recognize that it was part of the Orthodox and Reform battle. Now, one of the problematic things for the Ettlinger and others was that before the Reform even came on the scene with their anti-Mitzitza battle, the Chasam Sofer had been asked, was it permissible to abstain from Mitzitza B'peh and do it another way at a time of an epidemic? And he said, of course you can. And in his tshuva, he states that mitzitza is only a medical issue. There's no significance to it halachically. And maybe certain Kabbalists want to read significance into it, but he says, his famous expression, I have no ein li esek benistar, I have nothing to do with Kabbalistic reason. So when the Chasam Sofer himself is stating that there's nothing essential in Metzitza religiously, it became a harder test, but not impossible, to argue that it was significant. And basically, Ettlinger and the rest disagreed with the Chasam Sofer, and you can see in Sprecher's article a reprint of the Chasam Sofer. By the way, I will tell you that Rav Schechter makes a big mistake in his book Nefesh HaRav on this very point. For those who don't know, Nefesh HaRav, the Rav being Rav Soloveitchik, Nefesh HaRav is his book, the first book. His second is called Mipnine HaRav, in which he records the ideas and practices of Rabbi Soloveitchik. On page 243, I mentioned, in case those of you who have it, you can fill it in, he quotes the Rav, that is Rabbi Joseph E. Soloveitchik, as stating that today we don't need to do mitzitz at all. Now, when I first read this, I was shocked, because how could any Orthodox rabbi, knowing that in the 19th century this was a huge dispute, how could any Orthodox rabbi say you don't have to do mitzitz at all? And in the second edition, he notes that he was corrected, and the Rav was only speaking about mitzitz of the past. So any of you have only the first edition, you can have a note there saying that he was corrected, it's only mitzitz of the past. Now, when I first read this passage, I was certain it couldn't be correct, as I said, because this was a dispute in the 19th century that went on throughout the last half of the 19th century. And how could an Orthodox rabbi today say get rid of mitzitz entirely? Mitzitz of the past is one thing. However, this shows us something interesting, I think, because if you look at the matter from a purely halachic standpoint, ignoring the non-halachic issues, there is really no reason why a posek would not conclude that today, based on medical knowledge that we have, there's no reason to do mitzitza at all. That's why Rav Schechter, who's certainly a great posek, saw no problem believing that that's what he was told. Someone told him this was a Rav Held, he printed it, because if you just look at the Gemara and the Rishonim, it's only a medical issue, it makes no sense. However, me, certainly not a posek, but a historian, knowing about all the machokas between the Reform, for me, it was unimaginable that anyone could say that. But I think this is a very good illustration how, if you look at it from a pure halachic standpoint, there wouldn't be any reason to think that this is something strange, at least in my opinion. Yes, that's what he's quoted as saying, that his father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, was totally opposed to it and wouldn't permit it. And that goes back to Rav Chaim, because Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, Rav Sternbach quotes him, there was an epidemic once, Rav Chaim said, don't do mitzitza b'peh, and Rav Moshe apparently held you shouldn't do it ever. And the Rav, apparently, when he was at Bris, if he was asked, he would say, don't do it, but if people did it, he's not like Rav Tendler. He wouldn't stick his hand in and physically prevent the person from doing mitzitza b'peh. He said, and this is what Rav Schechter quotes him as saying, he's saying, I'm more tolerant than my father. Ettlinger declares, and this is hardly what we would say a precursor of a modern Orthodox position, that we cannot change halacha because of modern scientific evidence. In addition, he says, and this is quite interesting, although the sages spoke about medical danger, it could be that that's not the only reason. There's this idea that goes back to the Vilna Gaon that even though the sages give reasons, there could be other reasons. So the sages had a tradition, Ettlinger believes, that you have to do mitzitza. They were trying to find a reason for it, so they said a medical reason, but that wasn't an absolute reason. That was just a possibility they're giving, and really the practice itself is not dependent on the reason they give. This is a big argument already in the Rishonim, when Chazal give a reason for a practice, and the reason no longer applies, is the practice still applicable? Take a Mayim Achronim, that's a classic example, where apparently it's because of certain salt in ancient times, you'd want to get off your fingers, you touch your eyes, it could be dangerous. And the Tosfos says, well, we don't have that type of salt, that very sharp salt, so therefore we don't need to do Mayim Achronim. But others disagreed and said that, just because a reason's offered in the Talmud, that doesn't exhaust the reasons, and that's not maybe even the exclusive reason, it's just a possibility at getting to it. So much so that Ettlinger says, it could be that this is even halacha v'moshe mi-sinai, mitzitza b'peh, that since we see that our forefathers did it, it could be that this goes way back, all the way, it's part of the Torah. Now, later scholars also leave this as an option. Don't even leave this as an option. He says perhaps the Maram Shik, who's a Hungarian, a generation later, says 100% this is Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai. Now, when you see this type of response, and you see Achronim, recent authorities, say something like this, the Halacha historians take notice. And Yaakov Katz has a long article on this topic. Because no pre-19th century authority says this. It says that Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai, no Rishon, no one says this. So when you have someone, for the first time in the 19th century, not just one, a number of people, start arguing that Metzitza is essential to Mila, it's even Halacha Moshe Mi-Sinai, the Halacha historian takes notice. And what does Katz prove in his article? Well, I think he proves. He shows that in the absence of convincing sources which to refute the Reformers, after all, the Reformers are saying, let's get rid of Metzitza Bepeh. The Orthodox don't have such great sources, because if you look at the early sources, this seems to simply be a medical issue. What do? The Halachists were forced to come up with novel ideas and sources, giving the practice an entirely new basis, and often classifying what used to be regarded as an unimportant detail, for example, Metzitza, as a central religious obligation. And this is really the approach of Katz and all the Halachic historians on these sorts of issues. Now, I have to tell you that if you'd ask the 19th century Halachist, he would deny that, that his categorizing of Metzitza as central to the commandment has anything to do with the Reformers. He would say that this is the way I'm reading it. However, I mean, the Halachist is never going to agree that he's reinterpreted sources based upon these forces acting upon him. But the historian, of course, has to analyze trends and understand why it's only in that generation that Metzitza assumes such importance, and why the post-scheme are coming up with new and novel ideas. I mean, there really is a break between how the Halacha historian views matters, and I'm thinking of people like Ephraim Orbach, Chaim Soloveitchik, Yaakov Katz, Israel Tashma, and how the Halachist views matters. There's no different than the legal historian and the judge. The Halacha historian is looking at trends, is trying to understand why only in this generation this happens. He speaks about forces acting upon the Halachist, even if the Halachist is unaware of it. The Posek himself, however, can't be that self-conscious. He's like the judge. So they're really two different disciplines. Yes, the Posek does it without realizing it. That's the whole idea of history, that we can look back. The idea that other people understand you better than yourself, look, we all go to psychologists, right? Doesn't mean that we accept that. But historical knowledge is based on the fact that only in future generations we look back and we see trends. We see things that earlier generations didn't. But that's, I still think that the Posek, although when I say the Posek, maybe not contemporary post-schemic, for example, the Sri Deyesh explicitly writes it a few times that Posek X said this because he was influenced by what was going on. So some post-scheme who have a different sort of framework might see this, but at the time, I don't know if they would recognize this or even they would agree with it, and it could just be that the historian sees things differently than the actor himself, the judge. Yeah, we're talking about Chassam Sofer permitting forbidding prayer in foreign languages. That was a tough one. We spoke about that once already, because the Mishnah is explicit that you can pray in any language you want to, and the post-scheme saw what was happening to Tefillah and what the Reformers were trying to do. But I think in that case it's different. I actually think in that case, if you ask the Chassam Sofer, he would tell you, of course, you can pray in any language. But today, when the Reformers are trying to get rid of Jewish prayer in Hebrew, we have to try to find any justification, no matter how feeble. I especially think the Chassam Sofer would, because the Chassam Sofer is the advocate of a radical view that you're permitted to twist the truth and even lie for a good cause. He says that you can tell congregants, and Yaakov Katz discusses this as well, you can tell people that something is a d'oraisa, a biblical prohibition, even if it's only d'rabbanan, because we know that people often, if they hear it's a rabbinic prohibition, they don't take it so seriously. So he says you can actually tell them it's a Torah prohibition. So when you read the Chasam Sofer and his justifications, I think he might even acknowledge that, yes, I grant you that these justifications are very feeble, and that's not really, but we're trying to save Yiddishkeit. But it's a good point, and if you read the Ela Divrei HaBrit, which is the first attack, 1818, against the Reformers, all the respondents have to deal with this. How can they ban prayer in a foreign language when the Gemara, when the Mishnah is explicit and the Rambam and everyone that you can? If we have future sessions on the rise of the Reform movement, the New Orthodox response, we'll get into that in detail. Ettlinger battled the Reformers in another area as well. Rabbi Kelman says, or Rav Chaim said, will be an Isser of Baal Tosif. Maritz Chayas, you mean, says it's an Isser. It's the great debate between the Chasam Sofer and Maritz Chayas. Maritz Chayas says it's Baal Tosif.
Rav Chaim says to claim an Isser Doraita, Isser Dorabanan, Isser Dorabanan is an Isser Baal Tosif.
Oh, he says that as well. Okay, I didn't know that. In the article by the Frimmers, the two Frimmer brothers, they wrote an article on women's prayer groups, and in the back there's an appendix there in which they quote all the sources on both sides of this. If in the name of good rabbinic leadership you can twist the truth, and there's big names on both sides, and there was a case of where a rabbi wanted to tell his community that playing ball was usher on Shabbos. And another rabbi in the same community, I heard it from one of the actors involved, told him that if he does that, this rabbi is going to come out publicly and say he's lying, because the Ramah is explicit that you can play ball on Shabbos, and that the rabbi has to tell the people why he thinks it's wrong, it's not in the Shabbos spirit, maybe come up with different, don't have games where you sweat a lot. Just so this became a debate even in the community between two rabbis, one who thought that it was okay if that's the only way to get them to stop, and the other who thought differently. So it's a debate that continues to our day as well. I was brought up speaking a certain Hebrew. They taught me this is how Moshe Rabbeinu spoke, so it's hard for me to change it. And I believe them when they tell me this is how Moshe Rabbeinu spoke. Okay, let's continue. Ettlinger also battled the Reformers on the area of Yom Tov Sheni. The other big one was Yom Tov Sheni. The Reformers hated that. The idea that why do we have to observe a second day of Yom Tov anymore when we know when we have a calendar? And we know when it should fall out. Of course, they had a calendar 1,000 years ago also. It was an attempt by the Reformers to cut down the days that Jews didn't have to go to work, because we're talking the early Reformers, they still tried to observe the holidays to a certain extent. And Ettlinger was at the forefront of arguing that this is vital to traditional Judaism, it's a long-standing custom, or a takana. The Rambam is ambiguous. In one place he says it's a takana, in more than one place, which is a decree. In another place he says it's a long-standing custom. Either way, this never caught on, and the traditionalist rabbis are very strongly opposed to it. Although I will say that when the State of Israel was created, you did have a few Orthodox rabbis who floated the idea of Yom Tov Sheni abolishing it. Although I'd say today that it's a good thing, because if people are so troubled by it, they can all go on Aliyah, and then they won't have to observe Yom Tov Sheni, the three-day Yom Tovim. Although they never bother me. In fact, to talk about, though, we spoke about the Munkacher a bit, you should know that when the Munkacher was in Israel, the land of Eretz Yisrael, he purposely left before Shavuos, because he had this whole concept that in our day and age, it's a special segula to observe in the pre-Messianic era to observe the second day of Yom Tov. So he wanted Dafka to observe it. The other area...
Mark, yeah. Rav, when he went to Israel the one time in his life in 1936... Shavuos was on a Friday. He didn't know what to do for Yom Tov Sheni, and then he found out that Yom Tov was on Friday Shabbos, so he decided to stay in Israel. Otherwise, he was going to leave, so he didn't want to get into a suffix, you know, a Ben Chutzlar, how many days to keep.
That's interesting. And we know that, according to Rabbi Kefet, and I guess he heard it directly from the Rav, he asked his father, Rav Moshe, what he should observe. We all know this is a big problem when you go to Israel. Is it? Do you observe it like Israelis one day? That's the famous Chacham Tzvi. Do you observe it like we're in Chutz Haaretz? Because unless you're living there, you observe it. Or do the so-called one and a half, which is just really a misnomer. But and apparently the first one to advocate this is Rav Shmuel Salant about 120 years ago. I always am skeptical of things that no one thought of until 120 years ago, because what were they doing till then? Be that as it may, it caught on. That shows that traditional Judaism can be very dynamic, and new svaras, new ideas could catch on and become accepted. The idea is that publicly you don't, I believe, what is it? It's publicly you don't violate the holiday, but you still put on tefillin. And this, apparently, the Rav was told by Rav Moshe, this is the practice that he should follow. And a number of other, Rav Tukachinsky, I believe, held this, and a number of others. The other big issue was how to relate to the individual reformers. In the previous generation, the Chassam Sofer said that if the government would permit it, we have to place the entire Reform community under the ban. That is, they're no longer Jews. He says they will be no different like Karaites. What does that mean? This isn't just an expression. There was a, you could not put anyone under the ban. The government forbid it. But he says that if we could, we make them into Karaites. That means that traditional Jews cannot marry them, can have nothing to do with them. Just to show you what that would have mean today, there'd be no notion, for example, of Kiruv, reaching out to Reform Jews, because they're no longer regarded by us as Jews. They're a separate community. The Chassam Sofer thought that this was such a danger that we have to completely separate ourselves from them and have nothing to do with them. Entirely. And sometimes I wonder how the Kiruv movement in the United States will develop when so many of the people it's reaching out to are not halachically Jewish. I mean, if Eishet Torah has an event, there's plenty of non-halachic Jews there. You have people whose mothers aren't Jewish, who were converted non-halachically, or people who just aren't Jewish. They were adopted by non-Orthodox. So when Reform people adopt children, I mean, they're raised as Jews. They think they're Jewish. They end up in an Eishet Torah meeting. They're not really Jewish. And Israel, of course, is full of people who want to join the Jewish community, and there's a lot of problems. Are they going to be permitted to convert? The Haredi community, for a long time, was no lover of conversions, and I think they still aren't, although recently there seems to have been some changes. They're now at the forefront of trying to encourage people to convert for marriage, which for years, until about 5 years ago, they were at the forefront of saying, we don't accept any conversions for marriage. Now they have this Rabbi Tropper, and they're having this big event in Washington, D.C. They have all these gedolim on board saying that Dafka, we want them to convert if they're intermarried. And I think this is the result of all the Kiruv, because you have every one of these small towns that has a Lakewood Kol, well, half the people there are intermarried, or their children are intermarried, and what are you going to do? How could he be Makarev one person when the partner's not Jewish? You can't have a Jewish home. You can't raise Jewish children. The children are luckily Jewish, but if the father's not Jewish, you can't have a Jewish home. So whatever the reason is, they are now much more involved in converting people for the sake of marriage. Now, returning to the Chassam Sofer, who called for breaking away from Reform, his brother-in-law, Rav Shlomo Eger, Shlomo Eger was the great son of Rabbi Kiva Eger, he felt the same way, and he called upon Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, who was in Germany, where the Reformers were very strong and growing. He called upon him to place them under the ban, not an official ban, but say we want nothing to do with them. Reform Jews, they're like Jews for Jesus, I guess would be the parallel. You know, they're a different religion. Yes, Israeli rabbinate is indeed limiting American Orthodox conversions, because at the same time that they're pushing for certain conversions for marriage, they're tightening up the standards, what they see. It's a big problem, but it's gonna fall apart, I believe, because you have an organization like Tzohar, and the irony is that the only organization that supports the chief rabbinate, the RCA, their conversions, they don't want to accept them either. So we'll see how that plays out, because there's a disaster right now in Israel with all these Russians. Okay, getting back to Ettlinger. Ettlinger was called upon by Eger, Rav Shlomo Eger, to basically ban them all, say that we want nothing to do with them, and Ettlinger refuses to. He says, I will not read them out of the fold, even though they're Reform Jews. And a big machlokas develops in print, in letters, between Ettlinger and Rav Shlomo Eger. It got to be so heated that Rav Shlomo Eger writes that the only reason Ettlinger refuses to take this step is because he's given so much kavod in Germany. And if he really goes and takes on the Reformers, they'll make his life miserable, and, you know, he doesn't want that. But from Ettlinger's standpoint, his position is a principled one. We do not push individual Reform Jews away. Yes, we're opposed to the Reform movement, but we reach out to individual Reformers. Whereas, as I said, Rishon Meir's position, the Chasam Sofer's position, is that the Reform movement, which is made up of individuals, is a danger, and we cannot allow them to have any involvement. We're a separate community. What good, they thought, can there be in being in a community that has Reformers in it? So there are really two approaches you could adopt with them. You could either adopt the approach of the battling them, of the cherims, of reading them out of the fold, or you can adopt the approach of bring them close, use words of love. We continue to have the two approaches. There's Lubavitch and there's Satmar. I mean, it used to be, if you were in the 1940s and 50s, the Haredi world had a very negative view about individual Reform Jews. Now they're the leaders of Kiruv. Ettlinger actually claimed that the Reformers were the ones who made it an issue of personalities, and that from his standpoint, and the Orthodox rabbinate in Germany, they never had anything against individual Reform rabbis, Reform Jews. It was against the movement and against the rabbis. Now, in a previous lecture, lecture number 2, I believe, going back last year, we spoke a good deal about Hirsch's idea of Austrit, the notion that Orthodox communities cannot be in a communal framework with Reform. That is, you have a community in which we all pay taxes, and the taxes we pay go to fund the old age home and the Reform shuls and the Orthodox shuls, and we're all in one community. They don't interfere with us. We don't interfere with them. But we're recognized by the government, and we get together to do certain things that's best to do together, like fund the old age home, which, of course, will only be kosher food. But we're involved with joint organizations. And you can think of that UJA-type things where Reform and Orthodox get together. And Hirsch was very opposed to this. And in a later lecture, in maybe 3 or 4, I mentioned that Rav Kook was very opposed to this Austrit, this separatism, arguing that it was a terrible thing. Now, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook obviously followed his father in this. And he wanted to show that Austrit was a minority idea, that most of the great Gedolim believe that we must stay together in one community, Reform Jews, Orthodox Jews, because that's the only way we're going to be able to bring them all together. And part of the way he did that was to point out first that although Hirsch argued this, Hirsch was nothing compared to the Würzburger Rav, Bamberger, who we saw was very opposed to Hirsch's idea. Bamberger felt that you could be in one community as long as the Orthodox had their freedoms. Okay, so you have that. But then he gave an interview, and this was a famous interview because it was picked up. The German Orthodox didn't like it. He gave an interview in Hatzofeh, and you can actually read it in this book. There's a picture of Rav Tzvi Yehuda. Taking all his newspaper interviews, and they put it in a nice little book. And he claims in this interview that Ettlinger was also an opponent of Austrit, that Orthodox communities should be entirely separate from Reform communities. Now, it's one thing to say that the Würzburger Rav said this. After all, he got in a huge dispute with Hirsch on this point. No one's going to deny that. But for Rav Tzvi Yehuda to say publicly in Hatzofeh, which is the publication of the Orthodox in Israel, that Ettlinger was also opposed to Austrit was too much for the Hirschians. And David Henschke, a big scholar in Israel from the German Orthodox community, responded quite sharply to Rav Tzvi Yehuda with respect. I mean, he begins saying that, you know, it's not an easy task to respond, to criticize, B'nan Shel Kadoshim, Rav Tzvi Yehuda. But the truth is the truth. He might have even quoted the famous phrase that first appears in the Chavos Yair in the 1600s and has been repeated quite often. Love Plato, love Socrates, but love the truth even more. You know, that's... You can love, great authorities, but at the end of the day, the truth is more important. The fact is, and Rav Tzvi Yehuda was wrong, the fact is that Ettlinger never spoke about Austrit, either in favor or in opposition. In fact, the whole concept didn't exist until Hirsch made an issue of it and was able to get the liberals in parliament in Germany to go along with him in the name of conscience, that is, freedom of conscience. You shouldn't be obligated to support a community if you don't agree with it. But it simply didn't exist in Ettlinger's day, or maybe at the end of his life, it was coming on the scene. Rav Tzvi Yehuda's attempt to make Hirsch an opponent of his own teacher's ideology is simply false. It is wrong to say that since Ettlinger never pushed for Auschwitz, that he would have opposed it. That's what Sehuda says. He never pushed for it. But it wasn't even a concept. No one thought that there was even such a notion. It was Hirsch's brilliance to come up with this idea that there are now liberal members of parliament speaking in favor of freedom of religion. We can use that by arguing that orthodoxy is, in a sense, a different religion than reform, and we shouldn't be obligated to exist with them. And the fact that Ettlinger refused to consider the reformers a sect with whom we should entirely be cut off with, like the Chasam Sofer said, has nothing to do with Auschwitz. Auschwitz is concerned with organizational ties. That is, that the Orthodox community organizationally is involved with Reform organizations because that recognizes Reform rabbis, it recognizes the Reform institutions, the Reform leaders. Ettlinger was talking about individual Reform Jews. Even Hirsch never said that we're opposed to individual Reform Jews. He was as strongly opposed as you could be to Reform institutions, to being involved organizationally, but every Reform Jew he thought was a Jew simply waiting to do tshuva. Hirsch follows Ettlinger's approach exactly. Now remember, the Auschwitz law passed in 1876. Ettlinger died in 1871. And Hirsch, didn't really get on the scene until Ettlinger had passed away. In fact, if you look at Ettlinger's writings, you will find passages in which he speaks about how there are more important things than unity in the community. So much so that Mordechai Breuer believes that Hirsch was influenced by Ettlinger in moving in the direction of Auschwitz. In fact, Ettlinger even supported the notion of a separate cemetery for the Orthodox, because there's a notion that traditional Jews should only be buried with other traditional Jews. And let's not forget, both his top students, Hirsch and Hildesheimer, were separatists. So we see that although Ettlinger does have certain ideas, just like Hirsch, that so-called modern Orthodox Jews might be happy with, this idea that many modern Orthodox Jews have of reaching out to all Jews, even organizationally, boards of rabbis, etc., this was not something that Hildesheimer believed in, this was not something that Hirsch believed in, and this was not something that Ettlinger believed in. Every Jew precious? Yes. Belief in secular studies, yes, all sorts of things. But we already saw Hirsch's anti-Zionism. One of the important things to remember is that a number of these precursors, these architects, I'm calling them, of modern Orthodoxy, don't fall into what today we would call modern Orthodoxy. Let me note a few other tshuvot that I think you'll find very interesting. A few questions here. Rabbi Angel, yes, Rabbi Angel wrote about this. About the conversion issue. The problem with what the Haredim are trying to do is they're trying to create one standard. Now you say, well, one standard, that's nice. After all, isn't that why we have these VODs for, so everyone could have one standard of kashrus and everything? The problem is that the standard is always going to be very high. If there's one standard, I guarantee you that this standard will no longer be accepting of Rabbi Lookstein, of Rabbi Angel, of the religious Zionist rabbis. So really it's a smokescreen. When they speak about one standard, they're speaking about only their standard. Not to mention the fact that if you look at all the poskim, and Rabbi Angel has pointed this out, individual poskim might have their standards. However, if a conversion is done properly, b'diavad, it's 100% valid conversion, and you can't question the conversion. So today, all these conversions are being questioned. This is not traditional Judaism, as it's been practiced. And Rabbi Angel has pointed this out often. When I say it's not traditional Judaism, because there never was such a thing as one standard to bind all of Klal Yisrael. And already the Rishonim speak about Ein L'dayan Ela Mash Ein Avroot, that some communities felt they had to be stricter, other communities felt they could be more liberal. These were some things established by communities, and Rabbi Angel is at the forefront of, and I think he's 100% correct, in seeing that this is an attempt to take over. Before Rav Yashiv became the gadol of the Haredim, they wanted nothing to do with the chief rabbinate. The Brisker Rav put a cherem on it. Rav Yashiv comes out of that world. He believes in conquering the chief rabbinate and turning it into a Haredi institution. So it's really a different model. Before he was the leader, they didn't care about it.
Mark?
When you say Chabad Messianism, that is an exact parallel. Berger's idea of Chabad Messianism, that is no different than what the Chasam Sofer wanted to say. Although I don't think Berger says that you have a problem marrying them, that if they want to give up Messianism, they're fine Jews. The Chasam Sofer's point, if it would have been carried through, was that this is a separate community, And in the Ashkenazic tradition, the Karaites were regarded as having no yichus, and you could not marry with them. In the Sephardic tradition, they were much friendlier. In Egypt, for example, they're very close. And the Sephardim, including Rav Avadia, postulate that there's no problem. If a Karaite wants to become a Rabbanite, no problem with his yichus, you can marry them. Let me tell you a few tshuvot, which I think you'll find interesting, and some of it very relevant. When I was preparing these talks not too long ago, the Noah Feldman piece hit the New York Times, and this raised all sorts of questions, how we deal with intermarried people. Well, Ettlinger, almost 200 years ago, 170 years ago, 160 years ago, he was asked by the Chacham, the Sephardic Chacham of London, about a Kohen who was living with a non-Jewish woman. I mean, she was his wife and everything except legalities, because they didn't have there was no civil marriage then, and she had children with him, and he asked, can this man still be a Kohen? That is, can we give him the first aliyah? Can he duchen? I mean, he's with a non-Jewish woman, so you'd assume you'd lose your status of kahuna, and how can you even allow him to duchen? You know, he's doing something terrible. He's the equivalent of intermarried. It's interesting, first of all, why the Chacham of London would turn to Ettlinger. I think perhaps because Ettlinger was in Altona, right next to Hamburg. Hamburg has always had a Sephardic community there. Perhaps that was the connection, maybe on visits from the Chacham to Hamburg. He met Ettlinger. It was Chacham David Meldola. The Meldola family is an important Sephardic family. There's Rafal Meldola, who was in London before, wrote this, used to be a standard textbook for married life, halachic married life, Chupat Chatanim. Ettlinger's answer is that this should be permitted. And he explains that the problem with there's issues about a Kohen that he loses his kahuna if he officially marries with Kiddushin a Jewish woman who he's not permitted to marry. But if he's with a non-Jewish woman, yes, it's a sin. But there's lots of sins. We don't remove someone's kahuna because of his sins. Then you're going to say someone who shaves with a razor, or someone is a Mechal Shabbos. I mean, there's all sorts of sins, and he says we do not remove the kahuna. He says it should be permitted. He doesn't want to decide halacha l'maisa because it's such an unusual case. He says, but in his opinion, it's permitted. Other poskim do agree with him. And today I will say that we're seeing an evolution of attitudes in the Orthodox community towards intermarriage, and I would assume that as more poskim begin to deal with this issue, this tshuva of his, which I really don't see quoted, will become more significant. I'll just tell you that Rav Avadia Yosef, in a book that came out just this year, 2007, Tafshin Samach Zayin, states explicitly, you can call up an intermarried person for an aliyah. He says if the rabbi wants to he thinks it's a problem, he can prevent him, but according to halacha, you can call an intermarried person to an aliyah. I can tell you that the Lakewood Kiruv communities around the country, they give intermarried people aliyahs all the time. Half the people that go to their shul are intermarried. So this idea that you can't give an intermarried person an aliyah, I think, which was standard policy for a long time, it was more that's what it was, that it was policy. When people were interested in preventing intermarriage by means of certain social pressures. Today, it doesn't achieve anything. So if your intermarried cousin comes to your son's bar mitzvah, I mean, to say you're not going to give him an aliyah, that will drive him further away from Judaism. So I do think we're seeing an evolution. I had a long talk with someone who's in one of these Lakewood Kiruv communities. He's the only from person in town, and he says, of course, we all call up intermarried people. I think we do see an evolution, because I think if you would have asked Ravaron Cutler 40 years ago, he would say it's not even a question. Obviously, you can't give an intermarried person an honor. That's what an aliyah is, an honor. So it's interesting. Yes, I believe intermarriage, and I even saw an article from Aisha Torah about this, in which they said that today people who intermarry, they're not rejecting Judaism. It used to be, even if you weren't religious, you grew up in a community, you knew that intermarriage is a rejection of what it means to be Jews. Today, when every other person is intermarrying, and you're told that you can be a good Jew and intermarry, no one sees it. It's not lahachis. It's just another te'avon. Tattoos. What do you mean tattoos? What's the problem with tattoos? So it's an isser? Why? No. Whoever heard of banning someone from doing something because they have a tattoo? Why should that be a...
It's interesting. I had a bunch of my students ask me, is it true that a kid with a person with a tattoo can't be buried in a Jewish cemetery? I said, I never heard of such a thing. Maybe
well,
I'm
an urban
myth. I don't know. I never
I've
heard of such a thing,
no,
but I see
no, it's an urban myth.
Too.
It's an urban myth, but, you know, truth be told, if you look at the early sources in Rishonim, you'll find views that the only problem with a tattoo is if you do it as a form of in mourning for the dead or idolatry, but that technically, maybe it's a darabanan even, if that, just have a tattoo because you want to have your girlfriend's name on you. I mean, but tattoos, obviously, I mean, we assume that it's us and we don't do it, but tattoos is, I mean, Shabbos is worse than tattoos. Now, the Syrian community edict, have you read the New York Times Magazine a few weeks ago, was that intermarried people cannot be converted for the sake of marriage, and if they are converted for the sake of marriage, they will not be accepted to the community, and that applies even to an Ashkenazi. If a woman's converted or a man to an Ashkenazic woman, you're not accepted. However, as Rabbi Shama pointed out from the Syrian community, and they did not publish his letter in the Times. It's unfortunate they didn't, because that article, which quoted this Jake Kassin, who's not a scholar or not a rabbi, was saying all sorts of nonsense, that the Syrian community does not accept a lot of what he was saying, that is the rabbis. He accepts it, but not them. Rabbi Shama pointed out that there are plenty of cases in the Syrian community of children being converted, and there are plenty of cases of people who are converted being welcomed in the community, that the takana is conversion for the sake of marriage. They do not permit conversion for the sake of marriage. Now, it's true that the typical Syrian community doesn't want to have any converts, even if they converted when they were young, marry their daughter. But that's not the takana. The takana is they don't accept conversion for the sake of marriage because they saw that it was leading Syrian men to date non-Jewish women, knowing that they could just bring them back and have them converted, and the conversion then wouldn't be a real conversion. So they made a takana. Although it still is a problematic takana, because once someone's converted, even for the sake of marriage, it's a valid conversion. yeah, now there's a trend to no marriage. Let me give you two other responsa, which are fascinating. And the response I'm going to tell you now, I mean, it's almost like a movie, but people sometimes have this impression that, you know, things only became crazy in recent years. But in the small ghetto where everyone was religious, that's the situation we're talking about. Listen to this case. It's very famous. It's found, for those who want to check it, Volume 1 of the Binyan Sion, numbers 154 and 155. The case is as follows. A man was staying at a woman's house when her husband was not in town. She, like, rented... thank you, Dr. Lando. She rented a room for a man. Her husband went away for business. The woman was at home with her children and servants, so there's no problem of yichud or anything like that. There was a room in the house, and she let this man stay there. I don't even know if she made money from it. The husband was away. The story is the husband was away. This man shows up with ripped clothing, and he asks the woman for a place to stay. And the rabbi who wrote to Ettlinger says that this is a great woman. She's a very tsanua woman, a very modest woman. She lives in one of the small villages he's responsible for, because you had rabbis who were responsible for a few villages. Her rachmanis overcame her better judgment, and she gave the man a place to stay, and she fed him. But he wouldn't eat any meat or fish. He only drank water. He was a great ascetic. He afflicted himself greatly. In other words, he was a very holy man. All day he would sit in his room with a book, and she would hear him crying. He would stay up till late at night, and at midnight he would cry over the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. He never slept on the bed. He slept on the floor, and he used a rock for a pillow. And every day he would go immerse himself in the river, even though it was the winter, and the river was freezing. And he did this for 2 weeks at the woman's house. On the second Friday night he was there, after the meal was finished. And remember, husbands would go away sometimes for a month at a time, trying to make some money and bring it back. After the children and servants had gone to sleep, the man was alone with the woman at the table. And they started talking, and she asked him, well, who are you? He's obviously a holy man. And he said to her that he was sent from heaven, he's Elijah the prophet, but he can't reveal this to anyone. And Ettlinger goes on, and the rabbi writes, Ettlinger says that in her foolishness, this woman believed him. After she went to bed, the man remained at the table with a book, studying, and at midnight, He slowly comes to her bed, wakes her up, and tells her that he has gone through the entire land, and he didn't find anyone as righteous or as pious as she, and she is worthy to have the Messiah be born through her. The problem is her husband. He's not worthy. He was therefore sent from heaven to sleep with her, and she would have a son who would be the Mashiach to redeem the Jews. And as a proof that he's Eliyahu HaNavi, he said that on the next Tuesday, remember this is Friday night, after he leaves, she should open the chest in her room, and she will find a large sum of gold. But she can't open it before Tuesday. And she believed him, and they had sex twice on Friday night and once on Motzei Shabbos, and he ran away early Sunday morning, and no one knows where he is, as the rabbi says. The woman wrote to her husband. This is a real case. The woman wrote to her husband, telling him that he must return immediately because God has given them a great treasure. And the husband returns on Tuesday. Couldn't have been that far away. And she opened the chest, and lo and behold, no gold. Nothing's in there. She then realized she had been fooled. Obviously, we're dealing with very probably illiterate, unsophisticated woman. And she told her husband everything. And she tried to convince him that what she did was L'shem Shemayim, for God's sake. Because the man was so ugly and disgusting, she said that the only way she could have possibly done this was, for holy purposes. However, the problem is that according to Jewish law, a woman who's with another man, and she has to divorce her husband. At least the man thought so, as he turned to the rabbi. Now, it wasn't a rape, and according to Halacha, an adulteress, public adulteress, has to divorce her husband. So Ettlinger first raises the question, well, maybe there's no witnesses here, so it's not a problem. However, as the other rabbi pointed out, there were witnesses. The servants came in Saturday morning and found him there with her. Furthermore, the husband believes the wife, which according to the Shulchan Aruch makes it more complicated, and must divorce her. Ettlinger puts forth, here you want to save this marriage. This woman obviously is a foolish woman, and you want to save the marriage. Ettlinger puts forth the radical view that since everything she did was L'shem Shemayim, this is not regarded as if she's betraying her husband. What's the essence of adultery? It's a betrayal. You're betraying your spouse for someone else. This was not betrayal. She was doing this for L'shem Shemayim. And therefore, she has the status of an anus, as if she was raped. And that's Ettlinger. I mean, he's hesitant. He wants other gedolim to agree with him, but that is his conclusion. And you could use this tshuva, perhaps, in all sorts of creative ways. The Sri D'Esh discusses it. Let's say a woman who doesn't know thinks her husband is dead. I mean, there's all sorts of ways you could use this. It's a very radical tshuva, maybe the most radical. And I'll tell you that there's another Rav, the Rav of Vienna, Rav Elazar Horovitz, the Yad Elazar, who was asked the same question by the same rabbi. In other words, the rabbi was looking for a heter. When you have a case like this, you ask enough rabbis to find enough gedolim. And the Yad Elazar decides, as one would expect, unfortunately, it's a Nebuch case, but she's forbidden to her husband, no different than if she thought her husband was dead. But the Binyan Sion is Mekel and says he could stay with the husband. Let me mention one other tshuva, which is unique in his day, but has now become pretty standard, at least in the non-Hasidic world. We'll go for another 3 minutes on this, and then we'll stop, and I still have one or two more points, maybe in the beginning of next class, the first 5 minutes or so. Rav Ettlinger is responsible for something that is now, I believe, uniform in the Ashkenazic world. We all know that there is an obligation to hear Parsha Zachar. The parsha where we remember what Amalek did to us. This is Zachor, Zasher, Salach, Amalek, B'derech, V'tzeis, L'mitzrayim. That there's a biblical command, the only biblical command, to hear a portion of the Torah. There is no biblical command upon any of us to hear last week's parsha. There's a command that the community needs to read it, but as an individual, if you miss, for example, if you're sick or there's no minyan, fine, you missed it, no big deal. Parsha Zachor, there's a biblical command, we all have to hear this. However, it's a positive time-bound commandment. You have to read it once a year, and therefore, since it's a time-bound commandment once a year, women are exempt. No Rishon says otherwise. Especially, they tell us we read it now before Purim, whatever. It's a time-bound commandment. One time a year, everyone must read it. However, and as I said, every Rishon holds women are exempt for hearing Parsha Zachar. Ettlinger reports that Rav Nosson Adler, who's Rav Nosson Adler? Rav Nosson Adler is the great sage of Frankfurt, the Chassid Sofer's teacher, a very unusual personality. He actually, you mentioned the Sephardic pronunciation, he had a Sephardi live with him for about a year to teach him the Sephardic pronunciation. He was actually put in Cherem by the general Frankfurt community because of his Kabbalistic practices and everything, and his special minion existed until World War II. But he is a very holy, pious person. He held and he required the women in his little community, his little shul, to come hear Parsha Zachar. And Ettlinger, following this, adopts the practice himself. Before this idea is recorded in Ettlinger's tshuva, no one had ever heard of such a position, that women need to come hear Parsha Zachar. Now, I see it's already 10. Next class will begin with this, and I'll explain to you how this fits into the recent changes in Parsha Zachar, how we do things different on Parsha Zachar. No one 30 years ago, even 20 years ago, repeated the entire Pasuk of Parsha Zachar. We'll talk about how things have changed, and it really begins with Rav Yaakov Ettlinger and the requiring of women to hear Parsha Zachar. And following that, I want to point out one other very unusual tshuva, his notion of autopsies, and then we'll begin next class already after 10 minutes with Rabbi Zero Hildesheimer, who's the Talmud Muvhak of Jacob Ettlinger. But let me, it's already 10 o'clock, so if you have any questions or comments, we'll take those now. Dr. Lando points out tattoos. I'd have to look at that. I don't know if there's anything significant or anything unusual there. I know that some of these sites have now begun to discuss the issue of this permanent makeup. Does that also fall into the category of tattoos or not? You should know that there's a famous tshuva of Rav Ashri in the Tshuvas Mimamamakim, Tshuvas from the Depths, in which he was asked about the Holocaust people who have tattoos on them, and he doesn't think that you should get them taken off, that you should have them there, remember what you went through, particularly the women. Some women, they gave them tattoos with not nice things on them, and he says this is a chance to remember all the terrible things you went through and be thankful. So, any questions or comments? Hirsch was in Frankfurt when Ettlinger was still alive. And if I'm not mistaken, there's even, they have correspondence, but he doesn't speak about you know, his ideas about Auschwitz or anything, or he doesn't take a position. There's nothing in writing where he decides in favor of Hirsch in opposition to the Würzburger Rav, that is, that you should try to separate from the community. As far as I can tell, they didn't really have, even though Hirsch was a student, they didn't have really any dealings to any large extent. And I think the reason, perhaps, is when we say Hirsch was a student, I think he was only there a few months. So he didn't really develop like Israel Hildesheimer that close. Mordechai Breuer, I will mention, Shkoyach to Stanley Anderson, I will mention Mordechai Breuer, Zichrono Livracha, next class, only because he talks about a little bit about the development, but I'm going to say something that Mordechai Breuer doesn't say, and it all ties into the idea that we are now trying to find, pretty much, we're not like in the 50s now, pretty much, Shmiras Torah and Mitzvos is very popular, in even in the modern Orthodox world. So people are trying, you don't, it's not enough just to do the standard halacha. When everyone was eating out, you know, and you kept real kosher, okay, that was something. But now everyone is mocked on these things. You have to go higher and higher. And these are one of the things, you know, always trying to find something new. And it does show, again, the point we've mentioned, orthodoxy can be very dynamic. Orthodoxy is not traditional Judaism. Traditional means you follow everything you received in the past. Orthodoxy can be very dynamic. This whole idea of Rav Nosson Adler, and he could come around in the mid-19th century and come up with a chiddush, which then becomes, I'll point out in the next example, those who read the Sfarim blog, my next post, not the one that came out today, I'll call attention to something Rav Soloveitchik came up with. Just and you know, and I'm not saying this is wrong. This is something about dynamic, that new ideas can be brought up, which were never thought of before, and they become part of the Orthodox Jewish practice. A traditional society can never tolerate that, because a traditional society draws its guidance from what the previous generation did. But an Orthodox society is a dynamic society, and therefore new ideas can come on the scene, and that's for good and for bad. Otherwise, you wouldn't have one learning tomorrow.
In many ways, it's the opposite, though. In Orthodoxy, we know today. Whereas now we have a fixed orthodoxy in some of the issues with reform, in many ways we're much less fluid, the orthodox world and the traditional world.
I think the point you're saying is an interesting one. I think what I would say first is two things. First of all, the difference is that we have there's a lot of fluidity, but it's only in the direction of greater stringency. What you had in medieval times was fluidity and new ideas, but it's always in the direction, correct me if you think I'm wrong, always in the direction of leniency. Making it hairy, making it easier for the Jews, because you have the conflict, as Chaim Soloveitchik has written about, of life and law. And law yields in the face of life in a traditional society. However, I don't think today, I think you're absolutely right, today that would never work. Today we don't assume that the community as a whole is the Kol Hamon Kol Shaddai. We don't assume that there's any validity to community practices. So I think we only see the dynamism going in one direction. But I think in medieval times, the dynamism went in the direction of law agreeing with life. But the examples I'm giving you, Rav Nosson Adler and all the other ones I'm going to give you, it's not like communal pressures forced Rav Nosson Adler. The women weren't banging down the doors to come here to Parshas Zachor or any of these other things that we'll talk about. I think these are intellectual creations, which then affect our religious life. Remember, in medieval times, these are not intellectual, theoretical creations. These are real things, trading with non-Jews because of their holidays, all sorts of things, heteriska, goyshel Shabbat. Real life comes into play with halacha and some things. These are different. I think it's a different phenomenon, I think. What kind of life does Rav Ettlinger have? He has a life, he's still a pre-modern scholar. He's a Torah life. He's not writing scholarship in the secular studies. He's not doing anything like that. It was not a particularly different life. He lived as Rav for much of his life. He even had control over the civil matters. Shlomo Aeger, the Reform respected him in his community. And that's what Shlomo Aeger was talking about. He said that the Reform respect you, and if you go up against them, they won't respect you. So he did not have great struggles like the Sri Deish. He did not have great struggles like Hildesheimer or Hirsch. He lived as a communal Rav, and it was a fairly easy life, that is true. The next generation is where it starts getting difficult, because Ettlinger lived in Altona. Altona remained an Orthodox-controlled city his whole life, so he didn't have these problems. That's interesting. The Satmar Rebbe, that any Jew who has put on tefillin and arm tattooed was worthy of receiving kvitlach. Okay, so you see this. Now, I don't know. You have to ask a post-take. Let's say someone gets a tattoo just for the sake of getting a tattoo, and then they become religious. Would the post-take say they should take the tattoo off? I don't know. I don't know. That's the story about Rav Yaakov Ettlinger. I believe it's even mentioned in Blech's dissertation, which would mean it is reliable. It's been a while since I've read a dissertation, so I think it is. He's not the first to do that. There have been other people who requested this as well. I believe that is true. I believe it's mentioned in Blech's dissertation.
Mark, we'll let you go. It's 10:10, and yes, you're welcome. Anybody who wants to hear it, the allusions to a couple of classes like I mentioned earlier, you can just click on the bottom and go straight to download the MP3s from his previous classes, and we'll see you all next week, if not earlier. Tomorrow, Shani Terrigan at lunchtime, Thursday night's Parsha Shir this week is being given by Rabbi Riskin, Rabbi Shlomo Riskin, 9 p.m. Thursday night live, if anybody would like to sign up. And Alex Israel is starting his class Wednesday, 12:30, lunchtime, all-time Eastern Standard. We changed the clock. Noach, I don't know if that confused you a little bit in Australia. But anyways, his class is starting Wednesday, 12:30. And I want to wish everybody a good night. And you can always email a question.
And thank you very much. And I will. If those who find these things interesting, if you're interested in Hirsch, I'd recommend go to the Sfarim blog and click on the right, My Eulogy for Mordechai Breuer. There's a number of interesting things there about German Orthodoxy, including, I believe, we finally refute the oft-stated canard or legend that Hirsch went to the opera. Others did, but not Hirsch, apparently. So we'll leave it at that. Just plug in Google, Sepharim one word blog, B-L-O-G, and you'll find it. Lots of interesting stuff. Okay, good night, everyone.